Accession number 20271, Reel 3.
Ron Hill, Reel 3.
Well, as I was saying, with the aluminium of one of the MTBs, you only had to just touch it and it used to tear. So in the finish, it was a bit of a failure. In fact, both of them, I don't know. The numbers, incidentally, were, now bear with it now, 437 and 438 of the MTBs that was in the experimental squadron. And that's going back a few years.
What did you do next?
From there, I joined HMS Illustrious, which was a big... What I did, in actual fact, the reason why I joined Illustrious, I put in to go through for my next rate up, which was a leading telegraphist. And there was 150 on the waiting list in Portsmouth. So when I went up to the captain's table, he said to me, "You're recommended." He said, "However, I must tell you that there's 150 on the waiting list in Portsmouth, but it's a dry roster in Plymouth." So I said, "Yes, sir," and, you know, went away. And the captain said to me, because the captain's got to be there to recommend you, the captain said, "Do you know what he's trying to say to you?" I said, "What's that, sir?" He said, "Change port divisions." In other words, go from Portsmouth to Devonport. Well, HMS Illustrious was in Portsmouth at the time. So I went on board the Illustrious. Now, when you change port divisions, you change ships. And, of course, you've got to be the same rank as yourself, the same number of years and all that. And one of the chaps on there was, it used to be my class, Jock Johnson. So I says to him, I said, "Change port divisions." He said, "Well," he said, "I'm only an ordinary telegraphist. I haven't been rated tell yet." I thought, what the heck, you know. And another guy in the mess deck says, "I'll swap with you." A chap called Kemp, never forget him. So we swapped. He was supposed to go to MTBs. He didn't. He went straight to Mercury and did his officer course. And I wound up on the Illustrious in Plymouth. I left the motor torpedo boat at 9 o'clock in the morning in Portsmouth, in HMS Hornet. And at 5 o'clock that night, I joined HMS Illustrious, which was then the biggest aircraft carrier in the fleet, at 5 o'clock at night, just when they piped free gangway, which means that you could just go off the ship. Now, I'm at the bottom, and the two gangways join together. I'm at the bottom with me kit bag and hammock, and I looked up, and there's 55 million matloads going ashore down the gangway. But I'll tell you what I did there. If you recollect, HMS Truculence was lost in the Thames. Can you remember?
Yes.
And that was the end of 1949. And I was the duty sparker that night. And of course, there were three survivors off that sub. But that experience never left me, because later on in my career, about 3 weeks later, we lost the Afray. I was duty sparker again. Now, the Afray, of course, was never ever found for about a year. And one day, the reclaim, I think it was, sent its miniature submarine down, and it came up on the films, on the news, because he didn't have TV then. And there it was, and on the side of the conning tower, the word Afray just looked as if it'd just been polished by the brass man, you know, and they left it there as a war grave. Now, later on, and I'm going back much later after that, this was 1949, later on in 1971, I was chief of the comm centre in Gibraltar. And a submarine came in called the Alliance, HM Submarine Alliance. Now, my job was to make sure that everything went whatever they were doing with the trials, okay? And he was doing, working with two frigates, anti-submarine exercises. So I sent for him, this guy, in the morning, because I was chief of the Comsen, and the PLTEL came in with his killick called Harrison. PLTEL was Pat Keane, never forget him. And you never think then, when I spoke to him at 8 o'clock in the morning in the Comsen in Gibraltar, I'd be visiting him in the hospital in Gibraltar that night. Anyway, I said to Pat and his killick, I didn't take much notice of the killick, Harrison and him, and I said to him, anything I can do for you, Pat? Bearing in mind, as I say, I'd never forgotten the two experiences I had working with Sons. He said, well, Chief, he says, he was a PO. He says, can you keep watch on this frequency, which was the sub-safety frequency? I said, anything you want. He said, well, I don't know whether you're aware of what happens if a submarine goes down. They have buoys which are released, which go to the surface on certain frequencies, and they start sending their number of the buoy. And the number of the buoy, of course, is circulated all around the fleet so that you can put the number of the buoy to the number of the submarine. Is that the idea? So I said, I'll do that for you, which meant taking one of my lads from the inside and putting him out on a... But it's a boring job. He just listens on that frequency all day. The submarine was supposed to surface at, say, 4 o'clock. Now, being chief of the Comsen, I used to leave the Comsen about 3:30, and I'd be in my house for 4:30. You know what I mean? That would be normal day. Because remember, you don't go home for lunch. You stay there and lunch. But this particular day, I thought, well, I'll wait for the sub to come up. And you're waiting for the surfacing signal at 4:30. The submarine surfaced off Gibraltar, and as they threw the conning tower hatch open, a battery exploded on board. Now, when you go to surfacing stations on a sub, all the bunks are emptied. You know what I mean? Each one has his own job. The battery was below a bunk which belonged to an AB, and if it had been laid in that when the battery went up, it wouldn't be here today. But the battery was right next door, one thing below, the wireless office. And when the battery blew up, of course, Pat and the killick were inside the wireless office. There's only room for two, it's only a little place. And there they were in hospital that night. Up in sick bay, not sick bay, the hospital in Gibraltar. And I went to see him. There was I tell you what the ship he was working with, I think it was the Penelope. I won't swear to it, but I think it was the Penelope. And the Juno, I think, was out there at the time.
And which year was this?
70 or 71. But it was all that experience of what I'd gone through with being on subs and seeing the truculent go down, then the affray, then the Alliance. The Alliance didn't go down. As I say, the battery exploded just as it surfaced. It was out of play. It was just lucky that they'd actually surfaced, because they said if it had gone up when it was below the surface, it would never have come up because of the battery acid and the smell and the sulfur and everything else. So they were very lucky, very lucky.
So what happened to you in the Illustrious then?
Right, in the Illustrious. I left the Illustrious early in 1950 because they just formed the Foreign Service Pool. Now, I'd been home then. I came home in April 48, so I'd been home about 18 months. And I was a telegraphist. And they formed the Foreign Service Pool. And I went into, I was drafted off into barracks, and I was sent on 14 days leave. Now, with a Foreign Service Pool, what it amounts to, and remember, I was very lucky here because with me going to the Mauritius, I'd already been issued with one full set of whites. Well, I say two sets, you get two sets, you see. When you join the Foreign Service Pool, you're all jabbed up, you've got all your whites, your new issue, and you're all ready to go anywhere. Got the idea? And I was sent on 14 days leave. I came back off 14 days leave. Now, my father always told me, I don't know whether you're going to print this, my father always told me, if ever you're at a loss of what to do and you want to keep out of people's way, he said, you have a little clipboard with some papers on it and you walk around, whatever it is, as if you're going somewhere. See? Now, in barracks in the early 50s, the tannoy system is always going. You know, so so-and-so report to so-and-so, so-and-so, and it's a background noise, you know. So at 12 o'clock, I gets back and I goes and say, I'll never forget this chief's name, Chief Weldon, little fat chief. And I walked in to see him in the drafting section, and he says, where the bloody hell have you been? He says, I've been hunting everywhere for you, I've piped for you. I mean, as I say, it's a background noise, and I wasn't expecting a pipe, you understand what I mean? A chap had gone sick on the Killick's course, in other words, the next... I put in and swapped port divisions. Well, remember I said to you that the roster was dry in Plymouth. I was the only telegraphist in barracks that didn't have a draft check. I was on foreign service pool. The prize on the Killick's course was the Amethyst, which had just come home in 1949 from the Yangtze. She was doing a big refit in Plymouth, and the top person of the Killick's course was going to get the Amethyst. Now, in those days, all you had in the way of staff was a Killick and two. In other words, your corporal plus two people, two telegraphists. Got the idea? And when I came top, you sent straight down to the Amethyst on Friday. You see the captain, he gives you an HMS Amethyst cap tally. You get rated with a little hook on your arm, acting local leading telegraphist. And I was sent on 14 days foreign draft leave. In that 14 days foreign draft leave, I'd been home 4 days, I met my wife. But she was only 17 then. So when I'd done me 14 days, I joined the Amethyst. Korean War was just coming up, June. So they put a POTEL on board and drafted 4 boys. So I wiped me brow, because it's a big responsibility. And remember, I was only, 19, 20, just 20. And there was me with a hook on my arm in charge of a frigate, communications. And I went out to Korea. Now, with the Killicks being a dry roster in Gus, in Devonport, petty officers was a dry roster.
What is a dry roster?
There's nobody waiting. There's vacancies. There's nobody waiting to be rated up. It was just a dry roster. So when I was out in the... Of course, your acting time, normally, you wait about 18 months, 2 years, then you get the hook on your arm, then 9 months or 12 months later you get confirmed, and then 12 months after that you get recommended for POTEL. But my local acting time from the day I joined counted. So 9 months later, my proper hook came through. In other words, I could now drop the local and I'm acting leading telegraphist. 3 months later, with my 9 months local acting time counting, I was rated leading telegraphist. Now, you only had to wait another 3 months, and I put in for petty officer telegraphist. But because you're out in Korea, there's no way they're going to send you home for your POS course. So they instituted a thing called the provisional examination, which meant that you sat the examination wherever you were, but instead of getting, say, 85% for pass, you only had to get a 70. Now remember what I told you before about all my technical on the Mersus. Remember I'd worked with that chief? I was far superior for technical than anybody else, simply because he taught me so much. You know, for my age and rank, I was way above everybody else. So I sat the examination out in Hong Kong and passed. Now remember, I joined as a telegraphist, rated acting local, rated acting leading telegraphist. My two hooks came through. I was rated acting petty officer or acting PO telegraphist. So I joined as a tel and came home as a PO tel in 2.5 years. Pretty marvellous. And that's when I decided to get married.
What were your experiences in Amethyst and the Far East?
Well, I'll give you an example. We were anchored one day. We used to work with a New Zealand frigate called the Rotoiti. R-O-T-O-I-T-I. Rotoiti. Unbeknown to me, when we first met up with the Rotoiti, which is a totally different story, really, I was down in the wires office, and all of a sudden, I was piped for to go on the quarterdeck, and there was the captain. He says, "Captain of the Rotoiti wants to see you." I thought, what have I done? Because we were the commander of the task unit. So any orders that went from us, radio-wise, was wireless office. You understand what I mean? I thought, oh my God, what have I done? He said, well, you better go and get yourself changed. So I got changed into my number ones. No, captain, but motorboat came alongside. Leading to Legolas Hill, yes. Down into the boat, went across. One of the lads in my class in St. George, his mum and dad had emigrated to New Zealand. So he'd asked to be transferred to the New Zealand Navy. And he'd found out, you know, that I was on board the Amethyst. So he said to the skipper, I joined up with the guy in there, do you think we could... The skipper had sent this signal repair on board immediately, because I'm in a full sweat. And it was my classmate. And of course, they had rum then, out there. So of course, then they pulled me into the boat. You know, but anyway, while we were anchored there for a couple of days waiting for orders, because we were doing an invasion of, let me get the name right, it was an island called Chodo, C-H-O-D-O, and the Royal Republic of Korea Navy used to use what they called JMLs. It was like about the size of a tug, and they used to put the ROK Army on board, okay? And we were waiting for them to come up to us, and we were going to do the bombardments for the thing. Well, while we were at anchor, an aeroplane comes over. It's got smoke coming out of it. And he circles the two ships. Now remember, when you're in action, you're in a war state, you've got your Union Jack painted on your forecastle, and you've got your Union Jack painted on the sides. Got the idea? The same as the Rotoiti. And of course, we're all flying the White Ensign. So he circles us, smoke coming out of him, comes down for a better look. And of course, we're all watching, because we're all on the upper deck. We don't, come and see this plane. So the captain calls away the seaboat's crew. And this plane, and remember, it's as calm as glass. It makes a perfect landing. And it's floating. The pilot throws back his hood, and he climbs out onto the top, and he's unscrewing things from the cockpit. You don't know what he's doing, but you can see he's unscrewing things, and he's putting things. It could be anything. I don't know what it was. It could be his radio. It could be his watch. It could be anything. So the seaboat's crew is pulling towards the aircraft. Okay? Now, remember, the coxswain is the only man to see where the boat's going, because all the rest are looking aft. They're not looking to where they're going. Coxswain's the only man. So he says to the bowman, "Bows!" Well, the bows, of course, he picks his oar up, turns it forward, and slides it down the middle of the boat. Do you see what I mean? As he hits it forward, he hit this bloody pilot from the back of his head. He never knew what the hell hit him. He went straight over the side, and he woke up in sickbay on board. Absolutely true. And of course, everybody on the upper deck was going, oh my God. Because, I mean, the bows didn't know. He'd got the order bows. And he was going between, if you like, where the wing is and the fuselage. In other words, he was heading straight for the where his cockpit is. And he hit this fella straight on the back of the head. And as I say, he woke up in sick, mate. Didn't know where the hell he was. And it was off, I think, the USS Valley Forge. I think that was the name of the carrier. It was on one of the carriers. It was a Yank. Well, the next thing we know, we refused to let him go, because the doctor says, got to stay on board for a couple of days. But we'd signalled, because on the aircraft side is the name of his ship and the side number of the aircraft and that, you know, with the US markings and everything else. So anyway, we signalled and we said we got this guy on board. I think he was a, is there such a thing as a Captain JG? Something like that, I forget what it was. And they said, we'll send a helicopter to pick him up, you know, tomorrow morning or whatever. Because we said he's recuperated in the sick bay, but we didn't say what happened to him. So when they said he was going to pick him up in the morning, he says, we're not releasing him until we have a churn of ice cream. Because we don't see ice cream on board the ship, you know. Anyway, they did. They brought this new churn full of ice cream, dropped it onto the deck, and we put this pilot. And even then he turned down and he says, I don't know what hit me, boy, but by golly, it was big. And he saluted the ship when he took off. But I mean, you know, everybody was, you know, oh my God, probably can imagine. Even the skipper says, you know, it's absolutely true. I'll tell you another thing, and I'm going back a few years again. If ever you go into an ops room of an anti-killer ship, in other words, he's a submarine anti-killer, got the idea? You always have your sonar on, all the time. I think we called it Aztec in them days, it's sonar now. So in the background noise in the ops room, you get something like this. Bing, bing, bing. And it's going all the time, 24 hours a day. So it becomes a background noise, okay? Now we're running from Hong Kong up to Korean waters. But we're not at action station, anything like that, because we were not in the war area. So therefore, you're at what they call relaxed defence stations. Got the idea? In other words, okay, you've got your clips on your doors and things like that, but you could move freely around the ship as long as you did the clip up after you. So you're at relaxed defence stations. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, bing, 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 doop, bing, doop. And everybody's saying, what's the noise? They pinged a submarine. So, of course, there's a dead hush. And the skipper screams down the voice pipe, signal, FO2, FES, are there any friendly submarines in the area? Now, you've heard of the no-fly zone in Iraq, and you know that it's international. Everybody knows that you're not allowed in that area, otherwise you're liable to be shot down. Well, the waters we were going through, the same thing applied. You never met anything except a warship. You understand what I mean? So we sent this signal off, and the answer came back, negative. So the skipper comes down, and I had to encrypt it. Request permission to attack. Now, you've got an international incident here. Because it's either a Chinese sub or a Russian sub. Because the Russians used to play around and watch us what we were doing. Anyway, request permission to attack went off. About 20 minutes later, affirmative, because it's a flash signal. In other words, most immediate. And it come back, affirmative, granted. In other words, permission to attack. And we did a full-blown attack on this submarine. And we blew it out the water. Do you know what came up? The fuselage of an aircraft. No wings. No tail. USS Valley Forge on the side of it. Aircraft carrier. Nobody in the cockpit. He'd obviously come down. And a helicopter had taken off with him. But the fuselage had gone down to a certain level. I suppose there must have been air in this, I don't know. But I tell you what, we all wiped our brows, because when we saw this thing start to come up, you know, we thought, oh my God, you know. And so that's one of the things. Now, another thing is, and this is another funny one, I don't know whether you can spell this or not. When you're operating off the coast of Korea, especially if you're behind enemy lines, you had an awful lot of Republic of Korea people with radios. And you had certain schedules through the day. So on board your ship, you had a South Korean officer. And his call sign was Tog Nagy 5. That was his call sign. Tog Nagy is Korean for donkey. T-O-G-N-A-G-G-I. Okay? That's the way he wrote it down. He was late for his appointment. So I could hear this guy. And remember, they're behind enemy lines. And I suppose you've got other people that's, you know, listening out for these people. So he comes up on this frequency and he calls. So of course, this officer's late. So I jumped onto the mic just to let him know we could copy him. I said, "This is Tog Nagy 5, wait." And this fella burst into South Korean. And he was going out the clappers, and all of a sudden the door opened and this fella walked in. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I just called from your call sign, Tog Nagy 5. This guy was giving us all the groups for the where we're going to bombard, because that's what we're there for. And it was all the coordinates." He said, "How much have you missed?" I said, "A lot of." I said, "I couldn't understand Korean, but I've been listening to him every day, Tog Nagy 5, Tog Nagy. I thought I'd better tell." Anyway, this fellow came back and he gave us the groups. And then as you're doing the bombardments, the guy's telling you up a bit, left a bit, right a bit, and so on, you see. But I'll tell you what, I never touched that microphone again, whether he was late or not, because we had a POTL on board, Jock Rutherford. And he just looked at me and said, "You silly son," you know. That's some of the things that happened. Another thing is, we had a chap, again, I'm not mentioning any names. He was drafted to the British Fleet Post Office in Tokyo. He was a telegraphist. While he was there, unbeknown to him, there's a couple of girls sweeping up. One of them is the daughter of a minister who'd been sent to BFPO to practice at English. Well, apparently, the two of them fell in love. And they said to the... "Well, he's only a telegraphist." And they said permission to get married.
What nationality was she?
Japanese. She was the daughter of a minister in a high-up, an Amira high-up. And they said permission to get married. Well, of course, as soon as that happens, as you know, anywhere else, he was immediately given a draft sheet down to Sasebo, which is our naval base. She followed him down. He goes on board HMS Lady Bird and he puts in again permission to get married. So the FO2 Fez says, "Okay, you can get married providing you get your parents' permission." Meanwhile, giving him a draft sheet. They sent him on to us. The boat's going ashore to and from, and it's open to visitors on Sunday, and this girl comes on board. Beautiful. Oh. And how can I put it? Her English was impeccable. Mind you, she'd been at BFPO Tokyo for about 6 months, you know, practicing the English. Oh, beautiful. And you know what? He never lifted a finger the whole time he was in that mess while she was there. Whatever he wanted, he just looked, fag or whatever, drink, cup of tea. She did everything. Beautiful girl. And of course, we sailed. When we came back, we came into Kure. He'd been writing letters to her. When we get to Kure, she's waiting on the jetty. The permission came through from mum and dad. So he goes up to the skipperman. He's on board us now. Goes up to the captain and says, "Permission to get married." And the captain says, "Well, I'll have to get FO2 Fez's permission." You know, the one that originally said that he had to. So we drafted signals to FO2 Fez. Meanwhile, his draft ship was coming through to send him to Hong Kong. So he went ashore and got married in Kure. We never saw that guy again. And to this day, don't know what happened to him. He was a nice lad.